This is Noah Wall in conversation with John Mullen, Lord Northcliffe Chair of English Literature at University College London. I'm Ellen O'Neill, and today we're going to be exploring Charles Dickens's Night Walks. So, John, a few weeks ago you did an event with the UCL Festival of Culture concerning Dickens's Night Walks. Can you tell us a bit about that and what your role in it was?
Okay, well, the event consisted of taking a party of enthusiasts. I'm not quite sure who they were, actually, who would be such enthusiasts. But, I mean, not people from within the university, anybody who wanted to sign up for it, on a walk around some of the bits of London. Dickens walked around. He was a great walker around London in day and night, but he relished the night in particular. And at certain key places, there were readings or evenements connected to Dickens. So he started at the Dickens Museum, which is in Doughty Street, which is the house that he rented when he was a young writer, when he first made a bit of money from Pickwick Papers, and where he wrote a large part of Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby. And then it set off to other different venues. And I was waiting for the walkers at what's usually called the Fitzroy Chapel, which is this extraordinary, I mean, I can hardly describe it. It's an extraordinary chapel, which is was once part of the Middlesex Hospital, actually. So it was a kind of medical church. And the Middlesex Hospital has been knocked down quite recently and redeveloped in a rather sort of ghastly and anodyne way, I think. But the chapel's been left. And it's inside, I mean, outside it doesn't look anything special, but inside it's extraordinarily sort of inlaid with semi-precious stones and types of marble and a suitably sort of... what's the right word? A suitably otherworldly, really, venue for what I did, which was a sort of talk with some readings about Dickens and dreams.
Yes, one of the striking aspects of the Dickensian London, I've thought, has been the aspect of the hyper-realistic as opposed to the hyper-specific. Mm-hmm. You know, the ridiculous names, the caricature characters.
Yes.
Caricature might be the wrong word. Going down these incredibly finely plotted places.
Yes, it's funny. You say hyper realistic. I mean, that's one. Maybe that's quite a good term for it. I would say that realistic is completely the wrong word for Dickens, and one of the common misconceptions about Dickens's writing is that you sort of go to Dickens to discover what Victorian society was like. Au contraire, you go there to discover what Dickens's weird mind was like. He's a fantasist. He's completely a fantasist. He's not a realist in the least. Of course, his fantasies are rooted in reality, but we love him because of his weirdness. We love him because, I mean, I was talking about dreams, because for him, dreams, I think he's the first great writer, actually, for whom dreams are not, as it were, a sort of strange holiday from life. Dreams are a kind of amplification of what life is really like. And I think people will know from the experience of reading some of the most memorable bits of his novels that dreamlike is frequently, you know, a good term for them. That reality becomes intensified most when it is like a dream. So, when Dickens walked around London, he looked for and remembered specimens of the fantastic.
So could you give us an example of how Dickens uses dreams?
Well, in some of his novels, dreams actually become part of the plot of the novels, so that if characters would only attend to their dreams, they would actually know what was really going on around them. So there's the novel which has got most dreams in, Trivial Pursuits question, which Dickens novel have most dreams in? And the answer is Little Dorrit. And in Little Dorrit, one of the characters who's actually a servant, who's the sort of protagonist, Arthur Clennam's mother's servant, has a series of dreams. And these dreams actually, she thinks they're dreams, but they're actually sort of nocturnal visions which would tell her, if she did but know, what was really going on. She sees a double of her husband, her extremely unpleasant, manipulative and sadistic husband. And it turns out, his spoiler alert, that her husband has an identical twin and that there's a kind of nefarious scheme going on which involves him, and that's who she's seeing. In the last and unfinished novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, Dickens's last novel, which I think is wonderful, Durdles, the stonemason, who's the only man who knows his way round the seemingly sort of the gloomy and seemingly haunted cathedral at Cloisterham. And he is conned by the villain John Jasper into giving him a tour of its secret places. And he's bribed with lots of booze because Durdles is an alcoholic. And in his alcoholic stupor, he has a dream of what John Jasper is up to, which is actually the reader's clue as to his murderous plans. So, you know, sometimes it's quite literal in Dickens novels that you have dreams which are the or you seem to have dreams which tell you about the plot. But sometimes also there are dreams, I mean, the character, another Trivial Pursuits question, which Dickens character has the most dreams? And maybe people who love Dickens wouldn't be surprised to know it's David Copperfield. David Copperfield had lots of dreams, and his dreams are what I think they, what dreams often were for Dickens, and what he assumed they were for us, actually, which were things which take you back. They take you back to your childhood. And so David is possessed by dreams which jumble up the most important bits of his childhood. And Dickens used to say that he constantly dreamt of this terrible experience he had as a boy, which he replicates in David Copperfield, actually, which is when he was sent to work at a blacking factory, and he thought that he was going to work there forever, and that he was taken out of school because his father was in debt as ever, and he thought that was the end of all his aspirations, and he'd be working in this place till doomsday. And all the hope went out of him, and he always said, dreamt of this experience. He couldn't keep it out of his dreams. The great thing about what happens in his novels, I think, often is that, as in David Copperfield, that the protagonist's dreams are sort of wonderful jumbles of terror, Mr. Murdstone, and standing with the notice round him at Salem House School, he bites, all these awful, oppressive things that happen to him, and sort of comic as well, because that was one of Dickens's great gifts, I think, in his fantasy making, for jumbling up the terrible and the comic, as dreams, of course, do. That was one of the reasons Dickens loved dreams. Dreams are sort of tragicomic. Dreams mix up what we're most afraid of with the absurdities that are visited on us.
So Dickens's essay, Night Walks, in which he talks about wandering all over the city, begins with an experience of insomnia,
yeah,
which he says is caused for reasons that he will not go into. He explicitly, like, brings it up and then puts it aside. Dickens was quite a strange man in some ways, a certain idiosyncratic ideas about various aspects of life and personal life too. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Well, I mean, Dickens is sort of rather wonderful, I think. Strangeness is shown a bit in his habits of walking, actually. I mean, he's a juiced up person. He's not like you and me. He's a genius. I mean, that doesn't mean he was a nice person. That doesn't mean he was a kind person. It doesn't mean that he wasn't in many ways sort of hypocritical and self-deceiving. But he had an incredible sort of battery that he ran on, which enabled him to perform tasks which I think seem to us, you know, pretty superhuman. So not just writing his books, but living with a degree of energy that I find extraordinary. So often his walking, for instance, sometimes his walking would happen like this. He would spend his day working, writing, editing, I mean, pouring out stuff, but of an extraordinary high quality, and also editing other people's stuff. He ran for most of his career. He ran weekly journals, which he edited. So he would do his day's work. He was addicted to entertainment, both to being entertained, to going to the theatre in particular, but also to entertaining others. And conviviality as a host was one of his great virtues. And I think going to dinner with Dickens was fantastic. That's what he spent a lot of his money on, actually, the food, the booze, the occasions. And so, for instance, typically he might, after a day's work, go home, host a dinner for a large number of sort of friends and acquaintances at his London home. And then at the end of the evening, and it would be a bibulous evening, you know, Dickens thought that teetotalism was a vice. So at the end of an evening, which might involve amateur dramatics, I mean, you know, Dickens's dinners were not quiet and sedentary occasions. Everybody would go home, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, and he would go walking. And sometimes that meant walking to Rochester, you know, 40 miles away. Yes, that's what, I mean, you look surprised, won't come out on the sound recording, but yes, occasionally that's what he would do. He came from Kent, was where he had his childhood. He was born in Portsmouth. And that was where he sort of thought that his infant self was, even though he spent most of his childhood in London. He spent formative years in Kent, and when he made it big as a writer, one of the things he did was he bought the house, Gad's Hill, that he walked past as a boy. And that was his, you know, he was a self-made man. You know, he had 2 years of schooling in his whole life. That was his symbol to himself that he really had made it. But, you know, when he, I mean, he spent much of his time in London, and on occasion he would walk through the night, walk very fast, about at least four miles an hour. He would walk through the night to Kent. Now, he didn't always do that. Sometimes he walked around London. Why was he doing that? Because, I mean, he's not the first of sort of great writers who found it easiest to kind of compose themselves, to think, to live with their own thoughts and words when they were walking. You know, Wordsworth composed all his poetry walking. And then kind of recited it afterwards to his wife or his sister, who sort of wrote it all down. Why did he do it? Because he burned with energy, because walking was his way of being alone with his imagination. And when he walked around London, because he did that a great deal, I think, you know, it was partly for inspiration. I mean, he walked around London the same reason lots of people walk around. I walk around London sometimes. I mean, it's an incredibly interesting place. You always see new, strange things. But I think he did it in order to observe places and character types and vignettes of human behaviour, which went straight into his novels. And, you know, the London street is a place in his novels, just as it was a place in his life.
Something that struck me when I was researching this was the number of Dickens's novels that we have this very set idea of a Dickensian London, obviously, we as a culture, we could, you know, picture that, but the number of his novels that are set in different places, different periods, particularly A Tale of Two Cities is obviously set in the late 18th century, and, you know, other novels at different points, and yet we still add them up into this kind of cultural soup of a Dickensian London.
Yes.
Do you think that that's a fair thing to be doing? Do you think the construction of a Dickensian London comes from Dickens, or is it like a later thing?
No, I think Dickensian London does completely come from Dickens. There are very few Dickens novels which don't go to London. Hard Times, which is set in or near Manchester, is probably the only one. So, you know, even his last unfinished novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which is set in the cathedral, Kent cathedral town of city of Cloisterham, which is Rochester, basically, even that goes up to London for some of its key scenes. So yeah, London is big in Dickens, and I mean, the only thing I would say is that it's worth thinking about the paradox whereby Dickensian London has come to seem to some people, I think, maybe sometimes people who've seen Dickens on TV more than they've read Dickens, as a kind of fairly hellish place. And indeed, there were things about Victorian London which we would find a bit hellish. The smell of it, actually. Dickens is full of smells. Yeah, you know, the child prostitutes on the street. The absolute grotesqueness of the poverty of some. But Dickens loved London, you know. He relished it, not just as his sort of store of inspiration, but he loved living in it as well. And so I think it's important that there's a kind of gusto as well as a darkness in his depiction of London.
But the London, during Dickens's lifetime, London was growing enormously. It was also being pulled down. It was being rebuilt.
But it's always growing enormously. It's always being pulled down and rebuilt. I think it's a complete sort of misjudgment to think that, I mean, there are things about Victorian London, mid-Victorian London that are singular, of course. But I think, you know, I don't think it's sort of the fact that it's being constantly rebuilt, knocked down and rebuilt is something that we're unfamiliar with. God, it's completely like that now. And maybe it ever has been. And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, some of Dickens's novels are set in the past. They're not necessarily set in the age in which he wrote. So we think of, I don't know, Great Expectations. What a book that is. But I mean, we think of it as a Victorian novel. But actually, it's set in the early decades of the 19th century. It's not set in the second half of the 19th century, which is when it was written and published. And there's, you know, and that's an important thing in the functioning of the novel, that people have to travel by stagecoach in the novel. There's no trains, you know? And Dickens has to explain this to his readers. So he's quite careful about settings. And I think that we sometimes rather carelessly sort of conflate all the visual images from his fiction into sort of picture of Victorian England, which isn't at all what he was trying to give.
So what do you think he was trying to give then?
Well, I think there are one or two novels or one or two bits of his novels where he was passionate and aggrieved about particular social ills that, you know, he saw in the society he lived in. You know, Nicholas Nickleby is about these terrible schools in Yorkshire where people sent children they wanted to be rid of and where those children suffered and often died in terrible conditions. That was a social ill. There are bits of Bleak House when Dickens actually steps in and more or less hectors the reader about what's going on in the London streets all around them and the sort of conditions of the sanitary conditions that the poor are suffering, you know, who only streets away from the wealthy. There are those moments in Dickens, but yeah, generally speaking, I think he's a writer of the fantastic who's interested in the human imagination, in childhood, in our terrors. I mean, you know, things which aren't specific to the social conditions of Victorian England. And actually, I think as a social reformer, although there are things to admire about him, I don't think that's what's very interesting about him. I mean, he didn't have a very interesting or complicated analysis of what was wrong with his society. He was a sort of I think sort of a kind of Christian moralist, that's what he was, who liked sermonising about what was right and wrong. But if you go to Dickens for ethical or sociological analysis, you'll be really disappointed. You know, he's not like that. I mean, you could go to George Eliot for that and get it. You know, she is a brilliantly subtle, intellectually, psychologically and morally subtle writer. He wasn't at all. I don't want Dickens to tell me how I should live my life, but he could write sentences. He could create characters. He could make jokes like nobody else.
I was interested thinking about the darkness in Dickens, or where that does or does not come. Again, sticking with Oliver Twist, for example, there's the boys living with Fagin, who are, I think it would be fair to say, coded as child prostitutes, but not described.
I don't think they are. No, I don't think they are. There are prostitutes in the novel. Nancy is a prostitute, definitely. Dickens wrote a preface pointing out to readers who weren't sure that she was indeed a prostitute. No, the boys aren't, they're thieves. But I mean, it's interesting. The character Fagin is quite an interesting example, isn't it, of what tests us about Dickens. I mean, we're so squeamish. God, we are so squeamish about what writers in the past might have done. And find ourselves so readily embarrassed by their deviations from values that we have, but they didn't. I mean, Dickens is, you know, in a way, naivety is shown his representation of Fagin. I think the depiction is anti-Semitic, but Dickens was shocked to discover that people thought that, you know, and indeed to try to make, rather pathetically, try to make reparation in one of his later novels, by having a sort of saintly Jewish character, elderly saintly Jewish character, who was sort of to make up for what he'd done kind of by mistake in Oliver Twist. And when he edited later editions of Oliver Twist, he tried to make it less brutishly anti-Semitic. So he sort of erased almost all references to Fagin as the Jew. But then, you know, it would be a shame to be so embarrassed at the political incorrectness that we didn't notice what a vivid character Fagin's funny. I mean, not funny by mistake. He's funny on purpose. And, you know, we all know about that musical adaptation of Oliver Twist that was made. I mean, that was possible because of the sort of energy that was there in the creation. The star of Oliver, the musical, is not Oliver, it's Fagin. And in some ways, the star of the novel Oliver Twist is not Oliver, but Fagin. He's sly and malicious and witty and clever and irreverent, and has a sort of gimlet eye on the idiocies of respectable people. And he's a showman. They spend most of the time when they're in the thieves' lair practicing their thieving. And it's a kind of pantomime. And Fagin pretends to be a sort of respectable member of the public walking along and seeing if the artful dodger can sort of steal things from him without noticing. And whenever Oliver watches this, despite the fact that he knows this is bad, 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 he can't help but laugh, and that's what we're like with Fagin. So to some extent, I think it's just simply tedious to spend your time saying Fagin's anti-Semitic, or, you know, so many of Dickens, you know, Dickens had a funny thing about young women, either they're sort of fallen or they're saintly. Yes, that's a limitation, but, there are other things which seem much more worthwhile spending your time talking about.
So we've been talking about his novels, but did Dickens ever write journalistically or from a first-person perspective, personal perspective, about walking through London at night?
Yeah, he absolutely, he did. Quite late in his career, he wrote a series of essays for one of his own journals called The Uncommercial Traveller. And The Uncommercial Traveller is a sort of persona who narrates experiences which have their roots always in Dickens's own, and they're in the first person. And one of these, one of the best known, is is a description of a night walk around London. And there's a really striking a part of it, which is actually where we ended the event that I did at the Fitzrovia Chapel, which is where he's walking past Bedlam, the hospital for lunatics, which in his day was on the site and in part of the building that's now the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth. And his circuitous route around London takes him in this article past the walls of Bedlam. And he thinks of the lunatics, as they would have called them then, inside. And it's a really striking passage. He thinks about dreams and essentially says, you know, we're all lunatics in our dreams. You know, we all think we're having tea with Queen Victoria, which is apparently the most common fantasy that psychiatrically deranged people had in the late 19th century. Fantastic, isn't it? Apparently in the 1980s, the commonest fantasy of people who you found in psychiatric hospitals in Britain was that they had met Mrs. Thatcher. You know, so but anyway, having tea with Queen Victoria. But Dickens says we all have tea with Queen Victoria in our dreams. We all can fly. Lunatics think they can fly. In our dreams, we think we can fly. And actually, suddenly, the people who are confined within the walls of Bedlam are the people who spend all their time in a condition that we're all in some of the time. I mean, he's not, Dickens is not making a plea for sort of liberal treatment of lunatics. He's not saying, open the wards, let them all out. He's saying something about the human imagination and about how, at night he has a sudden vision of the world of our dreams and the world of lunatics sort of being the same. And he said, so really, it's just a very characteristically Dickensian piece of writing that as he walks, he fantasizes, or as he walks, he thinks about fantasy. And somehow the night concentrates himself into his own thoughts.
Sure, that's great. Do you want to do
a... Well, my absolute favorite, it's an easy one to pick because I think it's also the best one. I think it's the one that many readers and critics think is the best, which is Great Expectations. It's the most perfect one. It's the one also, this is a negative virtue, it's the one which has none of the aspects of Dickens's writing which sometimes embarrass us a bit or sometimes get in the way of what's best about him. It's unsentimental. It even has the nearest thing to an unhappy ending that Dickens managed. In fact, it was probably not time to go into detail. He wrote a really unhappy ending for it and was persuaded by his friends to change the unhappy ending into a sort of more ambiguous one. But it doesn't have that sort of that habit that almost all the rest of his novels have of giving everybody their due deserts or their just punishments at the end of the novel and giving the hero or heroine the right person to marry and be happy with forever. It's the most extraordinary book, and he had to write it. It's amazing because he had to write it in order suddenly to make up for the failure of a story that he was using by another writer, Charles Lever, as the lead item in his weekly journal. And the sales were going down because this story was boring and shapeless, so he had to suddenly supply something of his own. And I think the occasion made it, because he was originally going to write it for monthly parts, serialization over the course of a year and a half, and suddenly had to get these materials and concentrate them down. He suddenly had to get these materials and concentrate them down into a weekly form, and that gave the book a kind of intensity that is extraordinary. So, Great Expectations, funny and dark and sad. But not sentimental. It's a wonderful novel. I don't know, second to that, I think his other first-person novel, David Copperfield, is also wonderful. I think the first sort of 20 chapters of David Copperfield, which concern his childhood and adolescence, are just unmatched for a representation of the experience, the pains, and the muddle of childhood. But I suppose as a whole, Bleak House is a kind of greater novel. I mean, I do think if you're a first-time reader, maybe Bleak House is one to leave for a bit. Start with Great Expectations. If you don't like Great Expectations, well, then perhaps you just don't like fiction, I would say. You know, if you don't like Great Expectations, you're wrong. Try again. If you just want to laugh, Pickwick Papers, his first novel, is absolutely hilarious, I think. But yeah, Great Expectations. And then if you like that, maybe Bleak House.
Fantastic. John, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Pleasure.